She used to be a politician. Now she's keeping them honest. Danielle Smith on 770 CHQR.
Brought to you by the Popowich Carmeli Advisory Group, CIBC Wood Gundy.
Alrighty. I don't know if I have interviewed somebody who's written a Quillette article in some time, but there are always such wonderful, thoughtful pieces that just comment on, I think, the issues we should be talking about. I just wrote a column because during the course of the campaign, I'll be writing a column a week on topical issues. And when you look at this week, I was writing about immigration. And I know my views on immigration are offside with some of you, but here's how I look at this issue. I try to look at how they are all interconnected. Some of you are frustrated, and as am I, that we haven't been able to get the border under control. That if we did not have the illegal crossings happening at Roxham Road, I don't even know if we'd be talking about immigration the way we are. But what has happened is that there's been a massive erosion now of support for all streams of immigration. In fact, I look back on some of the poll numbers on this, 67% of people say that they do not think that we have the capacity to integrate more newcomers, therefore we shouldn't be bringing any more in. And only 37% said we should be bringing people in to fuel the needs of our economy. That is probably the exact opposite of where it might have been 10 years ago. So I connect these this way, that we have stopped having babies in rich countries. And as a result, but we have not had politicians stop making promises to you about how many social programs they're going to give you. We're now going to get, I guess, a dental program if Jagmeet Singh gets elected. We're going to get a national pharmacare program if Elizabeth May gets elected. We're going to see an increase to OAS if Justin Trudeau gets elected. And before and after care programs. Like, this is the problem, right? There's a crunch here. There are not going to be enough taxpayers to pay for all of the promises that we need to pay for in this elaborate social welfare structure that we've created. So you either then bring in newcomers, new immigrants to be new taxpayers so that they can pay for the ever-expanding state, or you reduce the ever-expanding state. I would vote for that one. Or you find a way to address the issue of encouraging women to have more babies, which has not been very successful in very many places. So this is why when we talk about the politics of procreation, it touches everything. And we're seeing it in this campaign. That's why I wanted to get into it with the author of this article, Joel Kotkin. Is the presidential fellow in urban futures at Chapman University in Orange, California, executive director of the Center for Opportunity Urbanism in Houston, author of 9 books, and frequent contributor to Quillette, the Daily Beast, and the City Journal, and joins me now to talk about it. Mr. Kotkin, is it Professor Kotkin or is it Mr. Kotkin? Thanks for joining me today. Professor. So let's then talk about the premise that you bring to this. It's really interesting to me. Do you know why it is that we have stopped having babies in industrialized rich countries?
Well, of course, you might need a psychiatrist for some of this, but I think there are several things happening at the same time. One, it does seem to correlate with a decline in religion. That's virtually everywhere. There's definitely a connection. You know, after all, if you've had children, as I have, they're a pain in the butt. They're expensive. They cause all sorts of, you know, short-term problems. Now, are they worth having? Yes. But for a lot of people, it's not such a good case. So we certainly see that where religion has declined in East Asia and in Europe particularly, and particularly in Western Europe, and increasingly in the Canada and the United States. You think Quebec, where my wife is from, used to have an insanely high birth rate. As it's sort of become more secular, the birth rate has plummeted. So that's one fact. The second is economics. It's basically the new generation is facing much worse economic situations than, let's say, my generation, the boomers, faced. And particularly in terms of property. One of the prerequisites in modern times of having children is, generally speaking, to own or have access to a single-family house. The planners in Canada, most of the United States, Australia, UK, are against single-family homes. They don't want people to have their own homes. And generally speaking, if people are living in a one-bedroom apartment, they're not going to have kids. That's just the way it is.
You have put a lot on the table. Can I ask you about a few of the things? Why has there been an increase in secularism and a decline in those who would declare that they're devout or observant in religion? Where did that come from? What was the impetus for that?
I think it comes from several different things. One, of course, is the fact that our culture has be, if you want to put it this way, has sort of lost its religious element. And the media is basically, you know, hostile to religion, except if it's, you know, a social justice warrior, they might be favorable to that. But, you know, if you look at the media portrayals of religion, they're pretty bad. So generally speaking, religion is devalued. It seems to have, I even find with my own students that they are, fewer and fewer of them have been to a religious school, whether it's a Catholic school or a Christian school or a Jewish school. Generally speaking, let's say 10 years ago, 50-60% had religious education. Maybe 10% do now. So over time, as each generation becomes less religious, they also leave a less religious imprint on their children.
You trace this to, I have traced this and to environmentalism that, and so I want to see how you link it, because I've seen that I gave the example of my husband who was born in 65. His Soylent Green came out a few years after that, and dad thought, oh my gosh, we're overpopulation, we can't have more than one kid. And so that's kind of been the messaging to Gen X and younger. Yeah. And I wondered if that was one of the reasons, but you also point to bohemianism as well as one of the reasons for the decline in religion. So what is it? Where did it start in North America?
Well, certainly the environmental movement is a big part of it. You go back to the Club of Rome report, which is, you know, I don't know what's been better debugged, you know, than that report. That report is, you know, almost every assertion is wrong, has been proven wrong.
And for those who don't, the main one being that we were going to the population was going to grow faster than our ability to feed it, and we'd all starve to death, right?
Right. And of course, you know, you have people like Paul Ehrlich claiming there'd be mass starvation in the United Kingdom. I mean, you know, you're sitting there. I mean, the biggest problem, you know, the United Kingdom has with food right now is too much. You know, so one is, you know, the environmental movement, and now that it's gotten supercharged with the climate change debate, one of their biggest things is we have to reduce population, particularly reduce population in those parts of the world that are the most affluent, because affluent people use more resources than less affluent. So that value has been very strong. The other big thing is with bohemianism is that the heroes of the generations, when you look at over time, how many of them had children? How many got married and had children? You know, you don't see a lot of role models out there in the cultural realm for anyone who is, let's say, thinks that the family is really very important. I mean, it's just not part of the culture. And, of course, part of it is that you have, and I've seen this in Canada and certainly seen it in the United States and Australia, you have the media is controlled from those very places where people have the fewest children. So, you know, if you look at a place like San Francisco or Manhattan, in Manhattan, the majority of households are single, not even married without children. They're single. They're individual, atomized people. And that kind of atomization feeds on itself. So it's never one thing. It's a bunch of things. It's economic, it's social, it's religious.
One of the things that you pointed out that I hadn't considered, I've been sort of struggling about why it is that there seems to be such a political divide between those who live in urban centers and those who live in the suburbs and rural. And this is what it comes down to, isn't it? It's whether or not you're single, no kids, living the life in a condo and able to go for coffee and go to the great shops and stop at a jazz bar, or whether or not you've got the obligations of taking care of kids and you're living in one of the outlying areas.
Completely the case. I mean, if you take a look at, for instance, the election in Ontario, you know, Ford was elected by the suburbs and the small towns. The central part of Toronto certainly doesn't want Ford as premier. You know, so see the same patterns in almost all these countries, and the people who live in the inner city, they can't have kids. And as cities densify and they begin to take single family neighborhoods and turn them into apartment neighborhoods, the families keep moving further and further away, because what the planners don't get is when people get into their 30s, most would like to own a house, get married, have a family. Now, the harder you make it, then people make the choice not to do any of it. And that's one of the reasons for your low birth rate. I remember working on a project in New York about children many, many years ago. And often the people would say to me, well, you know, I have a choice. I can have a family and live in the suburbs, or I can not have a family and stay in New York. And if being in New York was more important than having a family, you never had kids.
Okay, so here's what I don't get about why it is there's such a strong connection between being single without kids and being a progressive voter versus being married with kids and being a conservative voter. Hopefully you'll be able to shed some light on that when we get back. Joel Kotkin is my guest, presidential fellow in urban futures at Chapman University in Orange, California. Also executive director for the Center for Opportunity Urbanism in Houston, and author of 9 books, including contributing to a number of different online publications, including Quillette.com. You can read this at Politics of Procreation. Do stay with us. We'll be right back on 770 CHQR. Okay, Jason's got this figured out. He said, that's easy. Progressives want to tear it down, be free from responsibility, be mobile, and be carefree. Conservatives are less likely to move, to change their traditional religious and understand society across time and legacies. Therefore, they have kids. Another person here says, if you would quit substituting the word progressive for socialist, you'd have your answer. Conservatives want to raise their own families and keep the government out of it. Socialists want somebody else to do it for them. Aha, but this is why I'm confused. Because you're talking about socialists with children who want the government to pay for them. Like, why would some urban, latte-sipping singleton care that Jagmeet Singh is offering a dental program for poor kids? Why would they care that Justin Trudeau is offering a before and after school care program? Like, this is where I get disconnected. Why is it that those who are single seem to want their progressive politicians to be offering all kinds of new social programs for people with kids, and those with kids are the ones who are more likely to vote conservative? You see the pretzel that I'm getting my mind into here? We're going to see if Joel can sort this out. Joel, just so I can remind people of where you're from. Presidential fellow in the Urban Futures at Chapman University in Orange, which is in Orange County, California. I did check that out. Executive director of the Center for Opportunity Urbanism in Houston. So do you have an answer to that, or am I thinking of it the wrong way?
Well, I think firstly you have to understand the political dynamic. Progressivism now has two bases. One is urban affluent singletons, or people who are wealthy enough that they can buy themselves out of all the negative aspects of living in the city. They can buy a big enough place. They can get a country house. They can afford private schools. So that's one part of it. But there's also the progressives also have what you might call the precariat, or the, you know, sort of the working class that is working either at relatively minimum wage jobs or working or barely working or basically, you know, scratching out a living. And that's the other part of the base. So that part of the base is, you know, they're the ones who are the most enthusiastic about free college and all that stuff. And a lot of the hipsters see themselves as social justice warriors. So, you know, they would support that. What they also don't, but what they don't really care about is how effective these programs are. For instance, in California, where I live, progressives are big for more money for education, free this, free that. But they don't really care that the education system is a piece of crap. And they're not interested in the fact that minority and poor kids in California are doing very, very poorly compared to kids elsewhere. But they can virtue signal, say, well, I support more taxes for the schools, not, you know, recognizing that the schools don't get any better and that most of the money goes into the pensions for the teachers. So, you know, there are lots of unnatural coalitions in politics, and this happens to be one of them. But the reality is that I think where we are headed, and I think it is particularly clear here, is that we have a class of very wealthy people who want to create a permanent, you know, welfare constituency that, which will include what used to be the middle class. And that's really where we're headed. And I, you know, in the book that's coming out next year, I refer to it as the new feudalism, you know, where Mark Zuckerberg says, oh, well, you know, I'll build a one-bedroom apartment for you so you can work 80 hours a week for me. You'll never own anything and you'll never have a family. That's the ideal employee of a modern tech.
Okay, firm. Now just in case people think that you're too gloomy about this, one of the things that you do argue is that the more religious, more family-oriented population is likely to be the one that prevails. I mean, I guess if you're not having kids, obviously your ideology is going to die with you. Do you see a return to religiosity at some point in the future?
Well, I think that there's certainly going to be a return to those values that are sustaining. In other words, if you have values that are very strongly familial, you're going to have kids. Those values will be passed on. You know, San Francisco isn't going to reproduce itself unless they come up with a technology so they can, you know, create clones or something. So over time, they will lose. But in the short run, in the 10 to 20 years that we have ahead of us, a lot of damage can be done to the family culture in all the Western countries, and as well as in good parts of East Asia. So, you know, the real issue really is that yes, in the long run, the seculars will run out of people. And they're going to have to continue to try to convert the next generation of young people produced by families to abandon that idea. But it's going to be a long process, and it does mean that a lot of our politics in the next 20 or 30 years will be defined by those people who have children, particularly those people who have children. And one of the things that when you have children is you change how you look at, for instance, taxation. Like, you know, we have these discussions here where I talk to my wife and, you know, and we'll say, well, you know, maybe I like some things Elizabeth Warren's saying, and maybe she likes some things. I said, but you have to understand, Elizabeth Warren means that our youngest daughter, who's going to be going to, you know, to college in 3 years, is probably going to have $30,000 to $50,000 less a year available to her because we're going to be paying much higher taxes.
Well, at some point, you'd think there'd be some kind of pushback that the viability of the social welfare state, it can't be sustained by that few people paying that high a tax load.
Well, that's I would think so. I mean, I do think that we are headed to this. I mean, even if you take a look at California, where there's been a big drop in the birth rate particularly, you've got to wonder how long we can afford the pensions. And, you know, now we're giving the undocumented free health care. We're moving towards free college. When the economy generates a very small number of high-wage jobs, 80% of the jobs created in the last decade pay below the median, 40% pay under $40,000 a year at U.S., you know, you just wonder how long this can continue to go on. You know, I guess we'll see. But I think that there certainly seems to be a challenge to the sustainability of this system. And the problem is that we have now reduced the word sustainability into carbon counting, and that's all we look at, and we don't look at the sustainability of the society itself.
Wow, you've given us a lot to think about. I'm looking forward to your book coming out, and hopefully we'll be able to check in with you again.
That would be terrific.
You got it. That's Joel Kotkin, Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University in Orange County, California. Holy cow. Like, you see what I mean? This is why when you read Quillette, you almost get a little bit freaked out about all the things we should be talking about that we aren't talking about. This is a big deal. Something's got to give at some point. Either we got to all start doing our part and having more babies, or we got to start figuring out whether or not we can really afford all of the programs that the government wants and the politicians want to shower on us. Thanks for listening to the Danielle Smith Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts. And join the conversation. You can reach me on Twitter at @ABDanielleSmith or by email at Danielle@770CHQR.com. Talk to you next time.